launch panel. I'm pleased to say that we're going to have four speakers today for the launch of Konstantinos Kouvalakos, George Lukács' Philosophy of Practice from Neo-Kantianism to Marxism. We're going to start with the author introducing the book. We're then going to have Rob Jackson, Daniel Lopez and Richard Westerman responding to and opening up the discussion. We're going to do that for about an hour. So we're going to have four presentations. We're then going to follow that with Q&A, discussion, contribution, contributions masquerading as questions and so on. usual historical materialism thing. My name is Jamie. I'm an editor of Historical Materialism. I'm going to be chairing today. So whenever you're ready to get started, Konstantinos.
Now we are ready.
Thank you so much.
Okay, first I'd like to thank Historical Materialism for hosting this book launch here and giving us the possibility to communicate on my new book. I'm very happy with it, I must say. It's my first English book, so it's something very important for me, of course. I would also like to help the friends and colleagues here who came to help presenting my book. So I will start immediately with some introductory remarks, just to give you an idea what I had in mind when I started and finally finished writing this book. So, acknowledging Lukács' decisive contribution to the formation of the broad intellectual current of the 20th century, that we usually summarize as Hegelian, dialectical, Western, or critical Marxism, is commonplace among theorists of this tradition. It is also hard to overlook the influence of Lukács' famous book, History and Class Consciousness, on the political theory and practice of the activists during the 1960s. Of course, the great importance of this work is not only connected with its social-political radicalism, but also with its philosophical depth. In fact, the central essay of this collection, Reification and the Consciousness of the Proletariat, contains, among other things, the basic lines of a radical critique of the formalist philosophical and scientific discourse, and investigates the possibility of overcoming it in theory and in practice. Even if most theorists of critical theory are prepared to recognize the historical significance of Lukács' philosophy of praxis, this is not automatically the case in relation to its actuality. This is hardly surprising, since there has been a long sequence of critiques formulated, among others, by protagonists of this intellectual current, which have led to the view that Lukács is a finished case, and that any positive contribution of his has already been incorporated into what followed after him. It is typical that immediately after the publication of History and Class Consciousness in 1923, the Social Democrats began to criticize it for its theoretically and politically unacceptable tendency towards a social historical ontology and the theoretical exposition of a real dialectic of social totality. At the same time, the proponents of the new Leninist orthodoxy found the lack of systematic closure within the complete certainty of a unified materialist dialectic of nature and society unpalatable. Since that time, Lukács' detractors have never ceased to formulate contradictory critiques, which depict him now as an objectivist fatalist, now as a subjectivist voluntarist, in both cases mostly as an idealist philosopher. So this is the main charge, has always been, that he's an idealist. Even prominent theorists of the tradition of critical theory, such as Adorno and Habermas, failed to escape this trend towards a one-sided interpretation of Lukács' early Marxist work. Indeed, their critiques of Lukács became a model for the reception of his work by the younger generation of critical theorists. Although their criticism is based on different philosophical foundations, they arrive at similar conclusions. Both Adorno and Habermas credit Lukács with an idealist orientation. It is also interesting that Adorno's and Habermas' main arguments concur with those used against Lukács by Orthodox Marxist-Leninists, as well as representatives of the school of Althusser. My attitude towards this kind of appraisal of Lukács' early Marxist work is very critical. In my book, I suggest another way of reading Lukács' philosophy of praxis. At the time it occurred, Lukács' dialectical Marxism was particularly groundbreaking. Lukács' bourgeois education rendered him capable of confronting the opportunist social democratic theorists of the Second International on a remarkably high philosophical level to defend revolutionary politics and give solid philosophical foundations to it. In my book, I acknowledge the importance of Lukács' pre-Marxist philosophical dowry. I myself worked out in an earlier book of mine in German language. It's published with De Gruyter in 2014. However, compared to this earlier investigation, my new book is less historically and more systematically oriented. It aims at clarifying the dialectical practical theory of modernity exposed in history and class consciousness. In my book, I consider Adorno's critique of Lukács' alleged idealism as partly legitimate. In his brief critique in Negative Dialectics, Adorno presents Lukács as an idealist, a formalist who denies the otherness of the object, its non-identity, to preserve the omnipotence of identifying thought. According to my argument, it is not Adorno's criterion which is wrong, but his interpretation of the essence of Lukács' theoretical perspective. To strengthen this position, I investigate the neo-Kantian influence on Lukács' early Marxist work, as is reflected in the central position which the problem of otherness occupies in his thought. So this is the center of my argument. Such a reading might seem idiosyncratic and strange, given the dominant interpretation of Lukács' philosophical orientation. The aim of my book is to systematically show that a more charitable approach to Lukács' philosophy of practice is much more interesting, coherent, and fruitful than the more or less unfounded and theoretically unproductive prejudice that prevails in a great part of the critical intelligentsia today. From a general standpoint, the crucial question posed in the controversy between Adorno and Lukács is the question of the constitution of materialist dialectics. I am aware of the fact that emphasizing Lukács' neo-Kantian origins might create the impression of neglecting the Hegelian component of his thought. I do not at all wish to downgrade the importance of Lukács' turn to Hegel, and of course to Marx, without which his philosophy of praxis would never have been born. But another question still remains legitimate. What were the specific glasses through which Lukács viewed Hegelian dialectics and attempted its transformation into a materialist dialectic? What is the origin of his philosophical self-understanding on the basis of which he considered Marx's thought as a coherent response to the problems of modern philosophy? At the end of 1918, when Lukács suddenly decided to join the Hungarian Communist Party, he had already been systematically preoccupied with philosophy. Since 1912, he had largely left behind his previous engagement with essayism and the historical sociological investigation of literature, and had dedicated his work to purely philosophical research. This period coincides with his moving to Heidelberg to study philosophy and write a habilitation thesis under the supervision of philosophers of the Southwest German school of Neo-Kantianism. It would not be exaggerating to say that Lukács learned philosophy from the Neo-Kantians in Heidelberg. Thus, when he turned to Marxism, he was not compelled to limit himself to absorbing the Marxist dogma, but was able to read Marxist text in a new, fruitful way, based on the deep knowledge of the problems of modern philosophy he had already acquired. This becomes apparent in History and Class Consciousness, especially in the essay on reification and the consciousness of the proletariat. Lukács' frequent references to central protagonists of neo-Kantian philosophy of that time are a clear indication of the fact that the philosophical questions he dealt with during his study in Heidelberg continued to form the framework of his thought. Notwithstanding his criticisms, his references to Heinrich Rickert and Emil Lansky are remarkably positive. The Neo-Kantian influence on Lukács is also reflected in the content of his analysis. It becomes especially apparent in the formulation of the central problem of modern philosophy, namely the problem of the content of knowledge. Of course, with his shift to dialectical philosophy, Lukács intended to transcend the Neo-Kantian epistemological framework. However, we should not overlook two important facts. Firstly, the need for such transcendence had already been clearly discerned by Lask, even though he rejected the conceptual means of dialectical philosophy. Secondly, Lukács' understanding of the theoretical problems of dialectical method continues up to a point to bear the stamp of the Neo-Kantian reservations about it. Here is a very brief summary of my argument in the book. In the first part, I emphasize the Neo-Kantian origins of Lukács' analysis of modern philosophy, on the basis of which Lukács put at the center of his reflections the problem of content and the relevant problem of historical individuality, which he internally connected with the question of the radically new in history. Lukács attempted to find a way to overcome the so-called antinomies of bourgeois thought through his shift to the dialectical mediation of subject and object in history. However, in accord with the general orientation of Lask's critique of formalist epistemology, he conceptualized the mediation of subject and object in terms of the primacy of the content, the primacy of the content over the form. In fact, in Lask's transcendental ontological theory of meaning, we meet a quasi-dialectical understanding of the archetypical relation between form and content. This dialectic is incomplete and open, as the irrational content determines the rational form that embraces it, thus making any formalist primacy of form impossible. However, at the same time, Lukács moved beyond Lask's position by claiming the primacy of praxis over theory. Thus, contrary to what Lukács' critics usually contend, Lukács thought of the field of the mediation between subject and object, par excellence, the field of the dialectic of historical praxis, as intrinsically not systematizable and open. In the second part of my book, I investigate how the already mentioned dual primacy of the content and the radically new laid the fundament for Lukács' theoretical diagnosis of modern society. According to this diagnosis, in modern times, an instrumental calculated form of objectivity prevails, another central Neo-Kantian concept Lukács adopts, the form of objectivity. This form is prototypically realized in the universally implemented practices of commodity exchange, and it also embraces other fields of social life, such as bureaucratic administration, public communication, the private sphere of intimate relations, etc. In all its different realizations, the calculated form of objectivity oppresses the content of life. Furthermore, its domination effectuates the phenomenon of reification as the actual ossification of the dominant social relations and simultaneously the ideological obfuscation of their historicality, that is, the concealment of the permanent emergence of the radically new in history. The aim of the theory of reification was not, as Adorno would like to have it, to theoretically sublate the otherness of society and nature, but to reveal the social consequences of the domination of an instrumental identitary reason and to criticize it from the standpoint of the oppressed content and the emerging radically new. Finally, in the third part, I show that nor in respect to the practical process of de-reification would it ever be possible for Lukács' philosophy of praxis to aim at the identity of form and content, which it had previously revealed as the origin of alienation and reification. Examining the text more carefully, I show that the identity of subject and object, to which Lukács repeatedly refers, must be interpreted as their dialectical unity in the historical process, which, in its alienated modern version, takes on the form of their total separation. From Lukács' point, viewpoint, the goal of emancipatory praxis could never be the establishment of a metaphysical realm of the achieved identity of subject and object, an idea from which he explicitly distanced himself, but on the one hand breaking their false identity, and on the other hand consciously, practically liquidizing their relation. In this case too, I highlight the primacy of the content in Lukács' thought. For him, praxis always represents the radically new, while its dialectic relies upon the permanent adaptation of practical thought to the transformations of historical objectivity. Thus, the only plausible interpretation of the idea of overcoming philosophical antinomies through transformative praxis implies its dual understanding as a breaking up with the established identitary logic and as a momentary adjustment of the practical form to the otherness of the given content. Given the fact that Lukács used the language of classical German philosophy, what else could the practical transcendence of formalism and consequently of the repetition of the identical according to rational laws represent other than the materialist adjustment of the form and the content, the emergence of the absolute as the radically new? And this novelty, what else could it be but a new beginning, the practical creation of that which is not predetermined by rigid laws that externally govern human-made reality? It seems I have only 0 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, but I only have two more phrases to read here. It may be true that Lukács' terminology needs to be updated, but this does not mean that the dilemmas he encountered have ceased to exist. Quite the opposite. Naturally, because of the great historical distance that separates us from his time, the element that can regain significance for us today is rather Lukács' road and much less the solutions to problems he proposed. This road is, as Lukács wanted it in History and Class Consciousness, the method of the dialectical theory of social totality, formulated from the standpoint of transformative praxis and its collective subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So next we have Rob Jackson.
Thanks. Okay, hi everyone. So, in his recommendation on the reverse of Konstantinos's book, Jay Bernstein refers to Lukács' History and Class Consciousness as a book that is ahead of its time. This echoes, I think, a point that Frederick Jameson makes in his Valences of the Dialectic when he refers to History and Class Consciousness as a text that is, quote, yet to be written and which, quote, lies ahead of us in historical time. To a certain extent, Lukács' set of essays is like a time capsule that contains political, theoretical and philosophical resources that have yet to be actualised. What I think Konstantinos has done with this excellent piece of scholarship is to open up and take us along the path towards a concrete criticism by which that potential might be more fully realised. Of course, there are precedents for this work that Konstantinos duly acknowledges within his book, such as Andrew Feinberg and others. But I think we should recognise the impressive and detailed synthesis that Konstantinos makes of a very wide range of the international scholarship on Lukács. Particularly important for an Anglophone audience is the guide that this book provides to the German language corpus on Lukács. In his careful reconstruction of Lukács' thought, Konstantinos reaches beyond the commonly referenced primary texts analysed by Lukács scholars, for example through his exegesis of Lukács' various early writings, not to mention his letters to Paul Ernst. Indeed, one of the most stimulating elements of the book is Konstantinos' analysis of the various stages of Lukács' early thought to provide a genetic account of the origins of Lukács' framework in History and Class Consciousness. In my brief time, I'd like to offer a few remarks to outline what I consider some of the most important contributions of Konstantinos' book for those interested in Lukács studies and those operating with frameworks influenced by his thought. The close reconstruction of the development of Lukács' ideas from his early writings through to the essays of History and Class Consciousness allows Konstantinos to reveal a number of the well-known characterizations of Lukács' philosophy of praxis as misrepresentations of his actual positions. Thus, Konstantinos debunks diverse readings that see in Lukács' work a form of economic reductionism or an idealist dialectic of the immanentist or panlogicist type that Konstantinos ascribes to Hegel. Konstantinos also advances a searching critique of the theory of reification in Axel Honneth's work, which displays the common misattribution to Lukács of a confusion between the concepts of objectification and reification. This is not to mention Konstantinos' treatment of the frequent accusations of utopian messianism. and the notion that Lukács treats the proletariat, quote, as gods. However, rather than simply a case of heresy hunting, I find that this process of exposition is highly illuminating for deepening our understanding of the origins of Lukács' formulations and their embeddedness in the history of political and philosophical thought more widely. Konstantinas develops Lukács' ideas in parallel with those of the thinkers that influenced the development of his studies in various fields, such as the critique of culture, the sociology of literature, and later in Neo-Kantian philosophy, and finally in a dialectical and Marxist theory. Konstantinas' careful exploration of the dialogue between Lukács and the writings of Emil Lask, Heinrich Rickert, and Georg Simmel, among others, demonstrates their influence on his thought, and at the same time his critical distanciation from each. For example, Konstantinas demonstrates the early influence of Simmel's sociology on Lukács' study of literature, reworked later through his Neo-Kantian training en route to his conversion to Marxism, layering up these various stages in his development. In a fascinating section of the book, Konstantinas illuminates the connections between Lask's theory of lived experience and the genesis of Lukács' theory of reification. One of the advances that Konstantinas is able to make by working from the original German texts is to overcome a number of issues of translation that have hampered many prior interpretations of Lukács' works that are based on the widely available English translations. These issues of translation have obscured or distorted the active dialogue between his writings and those of other thinkers. Indeed, it is the translation of forms of objectivity, Gegenständigkeitsformen, that allows Konstantinos to make his central thesis distinguishing between forms of objectivity and the phenomenon of reification, the consequence of which is to disentangle the concepts of objectification and reification in Lukács' text. For the purpose of my contribution, I want to highlight the important role of the notion of crisis in Konstantinos' reading of history and class consciousness. I think his monograph is a very timely contribution because the notion of crisis has been absent in a number of works by thinkers that have inherited important elements of Lukács' thought. Thus, Moish Postone's Time, Labour and Social Domination provides an influential reconstruction of the categories of Marxist political economy that is heavily indebted, as Postone acknowledges, to the theory of reification in history and class consciousness. However, the concept of crisis is largely absent from this work. Likewise, albeit from a very different perspective, in his Beyond Capital, Michael Leibovitz retains the commitment to the proletariat found in Lukács, but equally covers over the link between crisis and the emergence of subjectivity in Lukács' work. For Konstantinos, finding an explanation for the crisis of modern culture plays a key role in Lukács' thought for a long time prior to his turn to Marxism in 1918. It remains at the heart of history and class consciousness because, as he points out, crisis represents the limit of the modern form of objectivity. As Konstantinos says, the double methodological and socio-ontological meaning of the concept of the form of objectivity points to the connection between the crisis of the dominant forms of knowledge and the objective economic, social and political crisis of bourgeois society. Both dimensions of the social crisis are due to the inadequacy of the fundamental form of objectivity of modern society, the deeper lack of unity and the conflict between rational forms and the contents of life that cannot be reduced to these forms without being violated. End quote. The recurrent phenomenon of crisis thus reveals the incoherence of what Lukács refers to as the quote, total process. Locating a path away from this catastrophe stimulates Lukács to formulate a transformative praxis that is novel in its dual characteristic of both rupture and process. This is where I think that Lukács' thought can provide a distinctive contribution in relation to contemporary debates on subjectivity. Thus, Konstantinos opens up a dialogue in the book between Lukács' dereifying transformative praxis and the ruptural conceptions of transformation that are elaborated by thinkers such as Zizek, Badiou, and others. Thus, Konstantinos says that Lukács' view on praxis as a break with determinism can be analogized to the contemporary concept of the event in theories such as Slavoj Žižek's and or Alan Badiou's. At the same time, Konstantinos argues that Lukács' theory of a radical break with the given world does not lead to the same paradoxical, quote-unquote, paradoxical consequences as these theories. Thus, he says, Lukács gives, quote, equally great emphasis to considering transformative action as a dialectical moment of an open process. As such, it does not realise a mythical final situation of reconciliation. It realises an immediate unity of the opposites that provide the material for a new chain of mediations, that is, for the further development of the dialectical process. Quote. Thus, far from an irreconcilable opposition between rupture and process, there is an uninterrupted process of moments which takes into account, as Lukács says, quote, the uninterrupted process of moments becoming independent and the uninterrupted abolition of this independence. If I had any minor reservations about Constantinus's text, I would perhaps ask about the absence of engagement with Frederick Jameson's interpretation of Lukács. As one of the major contemporary Marxist thinkers, his reading perhaps warrants a confrontation with the approach developed here. Like Constantinus, Jameson seeks to displace any ascription to Lukács, or indeed Hegel, of a mechanical synthesis of subject and object. His Valences of the Dialectic aims to restore the unpredictability of Lukács's dialectic and what Jameson calls the, quote, unsuspected dimensions of the problem, interrelationship and process, unquote. Certainly, this requires questioning, again, as Constantinos does, of the easy identification of Lukács's aspiration towards totality with a necessary slide into totalitarianism. It may be that Constantinus's reading is perfectly compatible with Jameson's version of Lukács's project to destabilise what he calls, quote, the multiple systemic webs of reification. At the very least, I think they share a number of commonalities. On a connected note, Jameson observes in Late Marxism that history and class consciousness is a fundamental engagement with Marx's 18th Brumaire. I wonder whether the philological work on Marx in Constantinus's book, which mainly deploys Marx's critique of political economy, could be expanded to continue the process of genetic reconstruction of Lukács's thought by analysing more expansively the influence on Lukács of Marx's historical works. And perhaps that influence is more implicit than the explicit references to the critique of political economy. Kavalakis's reconstruction of Lukács's thought shows the complex dialectical balance of the diverse influences, Hegelian, neo-Kantian and beyond, that are articulated by Lukács within his writings. He also makes a powerful case for revisiting dialectical practical theory as a means to overcome the weaknesses, or perhaps antinomies, of the contemporary theories of Habermas, Honneth, Mouffe, Rancière, Badiou and others. I think this can be seen as part of a broader need for rethinking critical theory, which is to some extent already underway. In the hard times in which we find ourselves, we need to ask to what extent the many critical theories of the past have lost their effectivity. The question of what it means to be critical today is one that needs to be addressed, and a serious re-engagement with Lukács, I think, is a part of reactualising these historical resources for use in the present juncture. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Rob. Next we have Daniel Lopez.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So let me okay, well, I'd like to begin as well by thanking Constantinos for inviting me to speak on this panel, and particularly for this book. It's a wonderful book, and it's an extremely scholarly book. I began to look at Lukács myself maybe 5 years ago, and it's hard to describe how shocking the state of the scholarship is from the 20th century on Lukács. As Rob said, and as Constantinos has said, any number of contradictory things have been said and continue to be said about Lukács. And really, this is a tradition of scholarship that was initiated by Abram de Boer and Laszlo Rudas, writing effectively in the service of Comintern apparatchiks. But then thinkers who are otherwise of an enormous stature, Adorno, Althusser, people from whom we have a huge amount to learn, you find them in the same camp as these mediocrities and repeating very similar lines. And so it's excellent, I think, in the last 10 years that a discussion has opened up about Lukács's most radical period that can begin to clear a space for a serious discussion of the man's ideas. And this is unprecedented. We were discussing before, there are traces of this discussion throughout the 20th century. Lucian Goldman, Merleau-Ponty, Andrew Feinberg, of course, was writing from, I think, the 60s onwards. And there's a host of other smaller figures and names that sort of turn up and then disappear. that figured out that actually there is more to this guy than just subjective idealism and the desire to liquidate all objectivity into subjectivity. But this was always a minority report, whereas now it seems for the first time the scholarly discourse has transformed such that we can really think about Lukács, and that's excellent. That's really good. I was reading just before I actually on the plane, which is exactly the right place to read this, a recent work by Martin Jay on Lukács. Now, there are some insights in this work, but he says about four times how unbearable he finds it to read history and class consciousness, which, you know, why write an article in that case? But, you know, the argument effectively is that because he uses Eric Auerbach's theory of the figura, and I'm not making any comment on that, which in Jay's description describes the emergence of a messianic moment which can be traced back to Christian messianism in realist literature. And he says this is the literary device which basically determines Lukács's writing in the 1920s. And so he reduces this enormously rich body of work to fiction, to just a literary device. And then what are we left with? We are just left with, you know, a sort of a cynicism that says, well, why read this? It's just literature. And so it's wonderful, I think, that situation has begun to change. Now, in my contribution, I'd like to talk about Lukács's relationship with philosophy. And my main claim is that Lukács opens a space within Marxism for philosophy. He's not the only one to do this. Of course, Marx does this. Other major thinkers do this. But I think that he opens a space for specifically Hegelian philosophy within Marxism. And I think this is very important. But I chose this angle because it speaks to what I think is the most outstanding aspect of Konstantinos' book, and that's that he foregrounds the neo-Kantian influences on Lukács so clearly and so admirably. And a confession, I have not read the neo-Kantians. Not many people have read the neo-Kantians, so it's excellent that someone's reading the neo-Kantians and telling us about them, so that we have a guide to this lost tradition, at least in the English-speaking world. And it's a special tradition because there are relatively few philosophical openings in history where thinkers start to consider the deep relationships between thought and being, and it seems that the neo-Kantians are one such tradition, and as is evidenced by all the people that come out of that, Adorno, Lukács, you know, some of the best minds of the 20th century. Now, others have noticed the importance of neo-Kantian philosophy for Lukács, but no one has gone into as much depth. But Gillian Rose particularly noticed this, and again, she didn't go into nearly as much depth. She writes, "The thought of Lukács and Adorno represent two of the most original and important attempts to break out of the neo-Kantian paradigm of validity and values, and their work has achieved renown as a Hegelian Marxism. But in her opinion, their work constitutes a neo-Kantian Marxism." She writes, "For the reception of Hegel and Marx on which it is based was determined by their neo-Kantian education, and the relation of their work to neo-Kantianism is the source of its sociological power and the peculiarity of its contribution to Marxist theory." And she goes on to argue, and this is an observation that's powerfully made by Konstantinos, that in the essay on reification, Lukács generalises Marx's theory of commodity fetishism, and in so doing, distinguishes between the total process of production, real-life processes, and the resultant objectification of social forms. And this is a nuance that has been lost both in translation, but with reference to the objective forms, has been lost by, I suppose, uncharitable readers that do not wish to see these concepts. Now, Rose does argue that this term has more in common with neo-Kantian notions of objectification and the specific object domain in which they exist than it does with a grand Hegelian historical ontology. And she writes, "By making a distinction between underlying processes and resultant objectifications, Lukács was able to avoid the conventional Marxist treatment of capitalist social forms as mere superstructure or epiphenomena. Legal, bureaucratic and cultural forms have the same status as the commodity form. Lukács made it clear that reification is the specific capitalist form of objectification, and it determines the structure of all capitalist social forms." And this is a point that's brought out beautifully and expanded upon in Konstantinos' book, because Rose spends maybe a total of 5 pages on Lukács. And it's a radical argument, because this argument, if taken seriously, suggests that capitalist social forms have no eternal validity, and that any such appearance is ideology and is illusory. And this, of course, opened up huge new domains of inquiry for Marxism. Now, it also demands, in Rose's estimation, a messianic subject-object of history, the proletariat, and a notion of praxis. And Rose was critical of Lukács for this. I'll return to this point briefly towards the end, but I don't wish to foreground this point in my discussion. Although, in all fairness, it probably does constitute a point of disagreement between myself and Konstantinos. Rather, what I'd like to do is use Konstantinos's work to introduce, as I see it, the existence of two contradictory discourses on philosophy within Lukács's philosophy of practice. So, the first discourse on philosophy is in many ways the one that sort of readily meets the eye when you read Lukács. And it's extremely nuanced, but it is a logical historical critique of philosophy as such, and an argument that Marxism stands as the only possible inheritor of philosophy. And in this sense, Lukács is on the same ground as Engels was when he made basically the same argument, that German philosophy had to be born by the proletariat and that with Hegel philosophy had come to a close. Now, I believe that one of the strongest virtues of Konstantinos's book is that by foregrounding the neo-Kantians, he makes apparent that this isn't the case. That in fact a new philosophical tradition, obviously indebted to Kant and to Hegel, emerged post-Hegel, through which it was possible to think anew, through which it was possible to think new historical events and to formulate a new historical situation. So if this is true, then it invalidates the first argument that philosophy came to close with Hegel. At any rate, let's look at Lukács's argument. So the Lukács that is against philosophy per se is, of course, a Lukács that agrees with Marx that to overcome philosophy, one has to go through it. And his traversing of philosophy is, you know, it's a landmark in Marxist thought. There's nothing like it before. And it took a long time until afterwards for something equivalent to be produced. But how does he criticise philosophy? From the outset, he historicises German idealism. And he argues that their insight is made possible by their unique historic situation. They wrote either as the living and sincere defenders of the Enlightenment, or in the case of Hegel, in the dying light of the Enlightenment, and with a capacity to see the beginnings of a new world on the cusp of capitalism. I think this resembles Lukács's periodization of bourgeois literature into a heroic, intermediary, and a declining phase. But that's neither here nor there. And so he focuses, of course, explicitly in the Antinomies of Bourgeois Thought on the writers of the heroic and intermediate eras, Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, and so forth. And these figures are capable of generating, respectively, intuitive, ethical, aesthetic, or logical historical concepts of praxis. And I'm compressing one of the most complex essays in the history of Marxist thought into a sentence, so forgive me. But they were capable, as a result of the historic vantage point, they were alive to the antinomies of bourgeois philosophy, and they refused to paper over any abyss between form and content, between subject-object. And this, in Lukács's estimation, constitutes the grandeur and the tragedy of classical German philosophy. And it's interesting, despite his occasional generosity, I mean, this is not a guy that's usually generous to the people that he's learned from. You know, he's got a strange relationship with the people that teach him. So despite his generosity occasionally to certain figures within neo-Kantian thought, he does argue that these guys, he faults them for wishing to paper over either the abyss between form and content or for falling into a kind of irrationalism. And so anyway, the periodization of philosophy is intensified and radicalized in the young Hegel, which, of course, he began to write in the 1930s and published in the early 1950s. And I think the reason that he turns to this is because if you periodize philosophy so sharply, and if you say that everything that philosophy comes to an end with Hegel, you have to ask very specifically about the nature of both Hegel's insight, but then Marx's break with Hegel. And so this really informs his research project, his interest in the young Hegelians, his interest in a reading of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit that finds in it elements of the commodity form. And at any rate, I think this leads to the second point. In addition to the historical critique, Lukács carries out a social meta-critique of philosophy, to use the contemporary lexicon. In short, he suggests that the universalization of the logical commodity exchange creates an abstract society, a society which is shaped by abstract social forms, and that this makes possible philosophical reflection. And, you know, Son Rethel continues this, sort of radicalizes this argument with reference to Greece and modern philosophy. And so this, in Lukács's view, is the obscure social grounds of the philosophies that he's interested in looking at. And then his approach to philosophy, especially in Hegel, is to radicalise their antinomies in order to reveal this obscure historical and sociological ground, and in order to prepare the way for Marx, so that Hegel perfects logic and he creates a system of logic that drives towards history, but this can only be fulfilled by Marx. So in this articulation, philosophy for Lukács is reified thinking par excellence. It's the most reified thought. And by virtue of its being the most intensely reified thought, it gives way to a thought that can transcend reification. And so again, this is far better than those Marxists of the time that thought, well, you know, maybe read a little bit of philosophy if you're that way inclined, but by and large, don't bother. So, Lukács wrote about this. Classical philosophy did, it's true, take all the antinomies of its life basis to the furthest extreme it was capable of in thought. Yep. It conferred on them the highest possible intellectual expression. But even for this philosophy, they remained unsolved and insoluble. Thus, classical philosophy finds itself historically in the paradoxical position that it was concerned to find a philosophy that would mean the end of bourgeois society and resurrect in thought a humanity destroyed in that society by it. In the upshot, however, it did not manage to do more than provide a complete intellectual copy and the a priori deduction of bourgeois society. So in that sense, for Lukács, classical German idealism is tragic. Now, this argument potentially leads to dark places. If you believe that philosophy comes to an end, then this interestingly refocuses on questions like the epistemological break that Marx made, which put Lukács into dialogue with Althusser and with Korsch. But I think it too easily leads to the kind of narrative that you get in The Destruction of Reason, that all philosophy after Hegel is a story of degeneration, and that philosophy becomes increasingly irrationalist and increasingly reactionary. I think this sort of superficial argument that exists in Lukács about philosophy is something that can close off philosophy as a sphere of thought. And once more, the argument is stop doing philosophy and just do Marxism. This raises all sorts of paradoxes and tensions. In the last 2 minutes I have, I will suggest what I think the unofficial line on philosophy in Lukács is, the more radical line on philosophy, and I think this is really brought out by Konstantinos' book. There could have been no antinomies of bourgeois thought without the antinomies of neo-Kantian thought. That is indisputable. And so, although superficially Lukács is staging the genesis of his philosophy of praxis as arising through an engagement with Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, etc., it also arises through a dialogue with Dilthe, with Rickert, with Lask, and with other figures that were so influential on him. And if it's possible to build a philosophy of praxis on the basis of those thinkers and that tradition, then it stands that philosophies of praxis can be articulated through with reference to other philosophies and other traditions that exist post-Hegel. In other words, this concedes an ongoing role for philosophy in thinking the present and in discovering ontological novelty. And here, we can take over Lukács' method. We can perform the same kind of historical metacritique and same kind of social metacritique. But I think opening an ongoing role for philosophy post-Hegel points to antinomies that persist within bourgeois life and within bourgeois thought that were not decisively resolved by Marx. It points towards tensions and points towards problems that continue to be thought. And this stands to reason. After all, new things have emerged since Marx. Hence, we can use abstraction and the self-reflexive abstraction of philosophy to think them. And I think this puts Lukács on a very Hegelian footing. This entails that Marxist philosophy, in order to understand what's new in the world and to understand itself and its way of looking at the world, has to be able to traverse the high points of philosophy in whatever period it finds itself. Now, this doesn't mean every philosopher is equal. One can probably not do this with Peter Singer. There are other philosophers that one should probably look at. But to my mind, this is an opening in Lukács that is really clearly foregrounded by Konstantinos' work. And I think that this constitutes a space within Marxism for philosophy.
Perfect timing. Thank you so much. And then our final discussant, Richard Westman, will speak.
Thanks very much. Before starting, I'd like to just briefly advertise my own book. I have flyers if anyone wants 20% off. But we're here to talk about Konstantinos' book, and I am delighted to be able to do this because it's one of the most important contributions I've ever seen to this very long overdue and very welcome re-evaluation of Lukács' work. As everyone really has remarked, the interpretations of Lukács throughout the 20th century were fairly stupid and one-dimensional. And so it's a delight to see a much more nuanced understanding of the sophistication of his work. Konstantinos really exemplifies this rebutting this kind of tired old charge that Lukács was some kind of romantic idealist, particularly by highlighting the importance of neo-Kantianism as a frame for the way Lukács takes up people like Hegel and the classical German tradition. But this more historically literate approach to Lukács raises a question of its own that is I want to talk about today. If we situate Lukács too much in the debates of his time, is there a risk that we then kind of treat him or reduce him to something like a museum piece? And we see this kind of claim, for example, in Gareth Stedman Jones' recent biography on Marx, where he tries to make Marx very much a figure of the 19th century in order to say that Marx really doesn't have much to tell us nowadays. Now, in Lukács' case, if we're looking at neo-Kantianism, there might seem to be an even greater risk of this because, as Daniel said, no one really reads neo-Kantianism nowadays. Hannah Arendt famously said that neo-Kantians drowned philosophy in a sea of boredom. And having also trudged through some of the stuff, I sympathise with what she said. But nevertheless, what I'm going to suggest today is, in line with what Konstantinos is saying, I think that actually this proper, intellectually, historically rigorous resituating of Lukács within his own debates, that's actually much more effective at helping understand what he's trying to do in a way that unleashes the potential of his work for today. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about those kind of methodological issues and some of the mistakes that past thinkers have made. Before talking about the way I think this new interpretation of Lukács helps unleash this kind of potential of his thought. In some respects, it's kind of surprising that we're here to discuss history and class consciousness, because apart from Machiavelli's Prince, there can't be many books that have been subject to such thorough and uniform condemnation, even by the people who've drawn from it. For a book that very few people have ever admitted to agreeing with, it's cast a very long shadow. Now, I don't want to rehearse all these critiques right now. Konstantinos summarised some of them, and his book gives a really excellent example. But the key thing that many of these earlier critics agreed on was that Lukács was in some way a kind of idealist. Very often the attack is that Lukács treats the proletariat like some kind of self-positing ego along the lines of Fichte's philosophy in the first version of his Wissenschaftslehre. Now, I'm not going to, again, rebut all of these lengthy arguments, because Konstantinos has done that, Andrew Feinberg and Mikhail Lurby have both offered rebuttals in the past. But what I want to highlight is a methodological flaw that almost all of the critics have made. They're very bad as intellectual history, just on a purely scholarly level, because they almost entirely ignore the discourses within which Lukács was situated and within which he was a participant. As Konstantinos has pointed out for us, history and class consciousness is absolutely riddled with the language and the conceptual framework of German neo-Kantianism. And the near-total failure to engage with this, or even spot this by most of his critics, leads to these terrible misrepresentations. And on the contrary, more sympathetic readings of Lukács are almost all those that have in some way recognised this. You can see this perhaps the most early version of this is Lucian Goldman's fairly esoteric reading, which kind of claims that Heidegger's Being and Time is a rebuttal of history and class consciousness. Now, whether or not it's genuinely the case that Heidegger had Lukács in mind, at least the fact that Heidegger and Lukács both have these links to neo-Kantianism, specifically both have very close links to Rickert and to Lask, then that kind of explains why these kind of parallels emerge. And then subsequently, people like Feinberg, Konstantinos, and so on have really taken this much further forward and in a much more kind of rigorous ways. Now, it's one of the categories that Lukács draws from neo-Kantianism that makes this more than just an academic question. And it's one that Konstantinos has emphasised to such great effect, that of forms of objectivity, or Gegenständigkeitsform. It's the recovery of this central term that gives Lukács' theory its renewed significance today, and which most thoroughly rebuts most of his critics. Gegenständlichkeit's form, for those of you who are not intimately acquainted with Neo-Kantianism, which you're very lucky, refers to the kinds of objects presented by different fields or discourses, and by the very often to the corresponding subjective attitude towards them. This is something Lukács stresses very much in the Reification essay. There's always an objective form and a subjective stance corresponding to it. And to give a kind of very horribly oversimplified example, because if it was this easy, the Neo-Kantians wouldn't have spent so long explaining it, I hope. Let's think about the example of a mountain as an object. If we're a geologist, we look at that for traces of glaciation, the kinds of rocks involved. An environmental scientist would look at the different ecosystems found across the peak. Now, although they're looking at different things, they're both adopting a fairly natural scientific perspective. The mountain for them has a natural, what we can call a natural scientific form of objectivity. The mountain there is an object that we stand outside as subjects, and we know it and we observe it dispassionately. If, on the other hand, we consider a painter, they have a very different relation to the mountain. The object, when the painter sees the mountain, they might see its latent possibilities for beauty, its symbolism, and so on, which then the artist has to interact with in order to select, to form them, to put them on a canvas. We are dealing, although with the same basic stuff, we are dealing with very different kinds of objects and very different relations to the object by the subject. And what Lukács does, so this kind of, for a lot of the Neo-Kantians, the question is, how does this shape different disciplines, different different fields of study? There's a lot of play on the difference between the human sciences and the natural sciences. Now, what Lukács does decisively in History and Class Consciousness is take this category and transpose it to a materialistic analysis of society. Institutions, collective practices, and social relations are all, in a way, forms of objectivity. They form an object in certain ways. And, of course, the elementary form of objectivity, the clearest example of the capitalistic form of objectivity in our society, is the commodity. What that means is, in practice, we act towards object as though they are essentially quantities of value, and in consequence, that is their social existence. Their interactions with other objects are determined by this kind of form of objectivity. So what Lukács is offering in History and Class Consciousness isn't so much a theory of society as a meta-theory. He's not really describing scientifically the way that a society that exists in principle outside of observation functions autonomously. Rather, he's raising questions about the very way in which we think of society as something to be known. Now, a lot of Lukács' critics miss this, and therefore they miss a lot of the point of his arguments and fall into the kind of problems that he's critiquing. So if we take, for example, whether we're looking at the Althusserians or the Habermasians, they're criticising Lukács in a lot of ways because his theory is a less adequate description of society and of social reality than theirs. But from a Lukácsian perspective, they're trapped within a form of objectivity that treats society as some kind of external object to be analysed in that way. So for him, that misunderstands what a theory really is. As soon as we treat a theory as merely a description of an objective world, something that can make more or less accurate epistemic claims about an object fundamentally independent of it, we're already making certain philosophical presuppositions. And to a certain degree, one of Lukács' aims is to bring those presuppositions into question. So by failing to kind of see that, by failing to see that Lukács is kind of operating almost behind their backs, this, I think, explains a lot of the misrepresentations of Lukács. Now, returning to Lukács on these terms does a lot more, I think, than rescue the concept of Gegenständlichkeit's form for contemporary application. Instead, what I want to suggest is that in certain ways it raises productive questions for those of us who study people like Lukács and past theorists, and those of us who engage with past theorists in relation to our own theory. First of all, it's just a basic question of intellect methodology in intellectual history. When we see Lukács as a participant in a particular philosophical discourse, when we treat his theory as an act or as a practice within that debate, that's how we're going to avoid this risk of reifying his thought, of treating it as something, as a fixed description of a world external to it. His critics, I've suggested, treat his theory purely epistemically, merely as statements that can be evaluated as to their truth content, ones that are fixed in meaning and fixed, therefore, in relation to the object which they describe but don't actually touch. On the other hand, if we place Lukács within the context of neo-Kantianism, we understand neo-Kantian concepts of forms of objectivity and standards of truth and validity, and we see Lukács above all as a participant in this discourse. We see that he's not simply observing the object that he describes. Rather, in extending these neo-Kantian categories to the analysis of society, he's taking an active role in constituting the form of objectivity itself. So he's trying to do something more than just describe society. He's trying to figure out the terms on which we should think about society and our relation to it. So the theorist is at the same time then contributing to the construction of the forms of objectivity of their discourse, defining and maintaining the standards of truth and validity of the objects they describe, as well as making statements about those objects. So in this way, we can start to think of social theory as a particular kind of practice, not one, of course, that can alter the world on its own, but one that plays an active role in shaping the terms on which subjects and objects can come into social relations. Any engagement with past theory, therefore, has to take seriously the 11th thesis. Instead of treating theory simply as reflections of an objective world or as crudely determined by underlying conditions, they have to be understood as discursive social forms, one way in which people act within this social reality. Beyond this methodological consequence, I think a Lukácsian metacritique of theories as forms of objectivity has deeper implications. First of all, it suggests that we, when we act as intellectual historians, shouldn't just view ourselves as dispassionate observers of the thought that we study. Instead, every time we engage in a new reading, we're creatively reframing a theory in a way that produces something genuinely new. Lukács himself does this, and he's a great example. He's addressing explicitly and clearly Marxist questions, but he's reframing them within this neo-Kantian, and Hegelian questions, within this neo-Kantian language. In other words, giving a neo-Kantian form of objectivity to these kind of Marxist issues. And by doing so, that's how he reveals a lot of these aspects, a lot of these implications of Marxist theory that may have been latent within the thought, but could have been obscured by the more obvious kind of economic arguments had he not done so. Most obviously, of course, he brings the question of commodity fetishism to the fore, something that really is very scarcely referred to in the literature before Lukács. And by doing this, by taking Marx's concept and treating it in this neo-Kantian language, Lukács develops a much fuller account of reification than Marx himself does. So we as intellectual historians can follow Lukács, I think, in this regard, to think about our own questions in terms of his form of objectivity and to think about, to transpose his question into ours. And finally, I think that this attention to forms of objectivity of other and past discourses can help de-reify our own reality. It's very easy for us to fall into the standard, particularly those of us who are academics, to fall into a very standard academic orientation towards the world, to treat the world as something out there, something fixed to be known. And we, you know, we assume that society there is there simply acting objectively. It is the dominant reified worldview at the moment. Lukács's critics have shared that perspective. If we properly explore the different forms of objectivity of these past theorists and of past worlds, that helps us. Just wrap up. Got a couple more sentences. That helps us conceive of reality in a very different way. And I will stop there because I've been asked to please stop. So thank you very much.